The reading this morning is from John, chapter 1. If you want to follow it in the church Bibles, it's on page 1068. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me because he was before me.' And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known."
See, thank you very much indeed for reading. And please do hold that passage of the Bible open in front of you, page 1068, as we try and work through it together. Let me add my welcome to Jamie's as well. We're delighted you've been able to join us today for the first of this week of talks event series. Well, our title today is "Why Doesn't God Make Himself Clearer?" And the great atheistic philosopher Bertrand Russell was once asked what he would say to God if ever he found himself standing in front of God and God asked him the question, "Why didn't you believe in me?" And you never quite know whether these stories are apocryphal or not, but Russell is said to have thought for a little moment and then to have replied, "I would look him square in the eye and say to him, 'Not enough evidence, God. Not enough evidence.'" It's a familiar cry. A friend once said to me, "I want to believe, I really do. So why does God have to make it so hard?" Just before Easter, many of us in this congregation asked our friends the question, "If you could ask God one question, what would it be?" And today's title was one of the most popular replies in that survey. Someone asked, "Why is your presence not more obvious?" Someone else, "Where are you?" Still another, "Why do you have to make it so difficult?" Here's how someone else put it to me once. "Presumably, if God exists and wants me to know that he exists, he could reveal himself to me in such an obvious and noisy way that I could never doubt him again. So why doesn't he?" In reply, I've chosen for us to look at these verses from John's Gospel this morning because they tackle our question head on. In short, what they tell us is whatever we may think, whatever we may feel, God isn't in fact playing a big game of cosmic hide and seek, in which every time we get close to him, he tries to run around the corner and hide behind a different star. But in fact, God has already acted to make himself abundantly clear to the world in and through the person of his Son, Jesus Christ. So the summary lesson we're going to learn this morning is that if we want to find God as he really is, we won't find him by heading off to a cathedral necessarily or to some mountaintop experience or looking deep within ourselves. If we want to find God, we have to look at Jesus. Two lessons from these verses, and the two lessons I'm going to draw are on the back of the notice sheet. If you wanted to be scribbling down any thoughts for later or something you can chat with about the friend that brought you along today, that would be a good place to do it. Here's the first one. Jesus enables us to know God. Jesus enables us to know God. About 18 months ago, I was taken to see a play at the Old Vic called Inherit the Wind, starring Kevin Spacey. And the play's a fictional account of the Scopes trial in 1920s America about whether the evolutionary theory of Charles Darwin ought to be taught in the schools. And the two main characters in the play are the two lawyers in the trial. One's a reverend, Matthew Brady, apparently representing the Christian view, and his opposite number, Henry Drummond, played by Kevin Spacey. And it's a play that captures brilliantly, I think, the mood music of our time when it comes to questions of truth and spirituality. Because it makes a really big virtue of being open-minded, but it makes it a crime to be someone who claims to possess the truth. And there's a key moment when Spacey's character says, "The man who has everything figured out is probably a fool. It takes a very smart fella to say, I don't know the answer." And so in the play, the fundamentalist Christians are portrayed as being out of date and anti-intellectual and anti-progress. And fundamentalist atheists are presented as being cold and heartless. But the agnostic character, who is open to everything but certain about nothing, well, he's presented as being kind and humble and warm and likeable. You'll see why I say it captures the music of our times. There are those two extreme views, fundamentalist atheists on one side, fundamentalist believers on the other. But our culture encourages most of us to take our seat on the fence, somewhere in the middle. There's a famous saying by the Greek philosopher Socrates. I remember being captured by it when I came across it reading A-level, doing A-levels many years ago. But I discovered the other day that you can buy it now emblazoned on the sides of mugs or across T-shirts if you're really trying to show off around the place. This is the phrase, "Hen oida hoti uden oida." Rough translation, "I only know that I do not know." I only know that I do not know. Seemed like a great excuse for not knowing the answers to exam questions. I dreamt for a little while that in an A-level I'd just sit there and write that out many times in answer to all of the things. You could feel proud about your ignorance. But he was saying, it takes a very wise person to know I don't have all of the answers. Well, these verses from John challenge that sort of agnosticism, you could call it, head on. G.K. Chesterton once said that the purpose, merely having an open mind, is nothing. That the object of opening the mind, as of opening the mouth, is to shut it again when something solid is put inside it. He went on, "The trouble with many today is that their mind is open at both ends." And in these first few sentences of his gospel, John aims to give a solid reality, authentic truth, upon which we can close our minds and build our lives. See, for example, what he says in verse 18, the last verse that was read to us there on page 1068. "No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He has made him known." I take it the first half of the sentence isn't very controversial. No one's ever seen God. That's why there's so much confusion about his existence and identity. That's why our question calls for more evidence. No one's ever seen God. But the second half of the sentence is the first bit of good news this morning. God has not left us in the dark about himself. Because John, the friend of Jesus who's writing this gospel, writes, speaking of Jesus, the only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. Let me illustrate John's point rather trivially. If you've ever hung around with someone who is visibly pregnant, you'll know that people come out with all sorts of theories, old wives' tales, that are supposed to tell you the gender of the baby inside the womb. Now, I presume that all of these were made up before the days of ultrasound, but it goes like this. Apparently, if the thing's sticking out the front a little bit, is this right, then it's supposed to be a boy. If it's a little bit more round the sides, it's supposed to be a girl. Or when Emily was pregnant, we were summoned to Somerset so that her grandmother could perform the test. So Emily had to lie down on the floor, and the grandmother got hold of a piece of cotton with a needle attached to the end of it and dangled it above Emily's belly. And here's the way it was supposed to work. I think if I get this right, if the thing swung in a clockwise direction, it was going to be a boy, and if it swung in an anti-clockwise direction, it was going to be a girl. What actually happened is that the test was performed twice with mixed results. So the first time it swung one way, and the second time, I was slightly disconcerted by this. As a prospective father, it's a thing to worry about. So I asked what we should deduce from the results. And I was told with absolute sincerity by this sweet 90-something-year-old lady, it meant that for absolutely sure we would be having either a boy or a girl. And I distinctly remember thinking, I drove to Somerset for this moment. It was all a bit of fun, but obviously those tests can only ever be guesswork. But of course, once the baby comes out, then all of the guessing games can stop. Down the centuries, there have been countless theories about the nature of God. People still today say, I like to think of God as, and then they give you their pet theory. But for as long as God remains hidden in heaven, and unless and until he, as it were, comes out and chooses to reveal himself to us, the point is that it's all guesswork. But here in these verses, John says, the guessing games can stop. Because God the Son came from heaven to reveal God to us so that we might know him. See how verse 14 puts it. The word, speaking of Jesus again, became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory. Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. It's saying when we look at Jesus, we see God as he really is. That's what it means when it says we see God's glory here. It means that Jesus is not just a pale imitation or an approximation of God, but God as he is, perfectly revealed to mankind. So I suppose the question is, if ever you were to stop and think about Jesus, as we're encouraging you to do this morning and throughout this week of talks, how big is Jesus in your mind? Maybe at some point a Christian friend or a colleague has said to you that Jesus is so important that you ought to give some time to investigating him. We often say here that one of the best ways of doing that is to take away an account of the life of Jesus. There are piles of them under the gallery there on the table. And to read through the rest of this account written by John, historical account of the life of Jesus. And ask yourself the question, who do I think he is? Is he worthy of this claim to be God on earth? Now, I hope you will want to do that this morning. But actually, these verses are saying a little bit more than, well, maybe have a think about Jesus if you feel like it. Rather, they're demanding that we sit up and take notice of him. They're saying he's bigger than you think he is. They're saying this man is your maker. He is your God. A year or so ago, the Tate Modern had an exhibition by an artist called Miroslav Balka that consisted of nothing, as far as I could tell, apart from a very large black box. Perhaps you went and saw it. It was meant to explore how we interact with the unknown. And so as you walked up a slope into a room, everything was entirely dark. And it was meant to be disconcerting and unsettling, and it was. Because as you wandered in, you could see absolutely nothing, and you weren't sure if the floor was going to be level. Would you find yourself falling down a hole, or bumping into somebody else that was in there as well, or treading on a small child, or anything like that? You had no idea quite what was going to happen inside the box. A poster outside said, "The unknown can be terrifying, especially if it is also without light." The wonder of Jesus is that we no longer need to be in the dark about God. You may remember he once said, "I am the light of the world." And he was claiming to be able to turn the lights on, to end the confusion, and to introduce us to God as he really is. In his book, In God We Doubt, John Humphreys speaks of his ultimate failure to find big answers to life's big questions about life and about God. He says this, "Along the way, I've experienced the indoctrination of confirmation classes, the anticlimax of the Eucharist, and the futility of prayer. So I end up, so far at any rate, as a doubter." But again, we don't need to be imprisoned to doubt any longer. Jesus is the living answer to our questions. He enables us to know truth about God because he is God. I have to say, that's the way it worked in my own life as well. I grew up believing abstractly in the possible existence, the probable existence even, of a God. But I knew that I was entirely in the dark as to his exact nature. A bit like when you're in a big old house somewhere and you can hear someone moving around upstairs, but you're not sure who they are or what they've got to do with you. Well, so God was a distant and impersonal concept. I only know that I do not know. He was just too far away. But of course, he doesn't need to be. And my experience of meeting Jesus in the Bible was that here was God come through the ceiling. He enables us to know God. Not just facts about God, but God. We can know God. So in answer to the question, why doesn't God make himself clearer? God would reply, "I already have. Take a closer look at my son." Had lunch with a man recently who told me that when it comes to the things of God, he is chasing shadows. That was his phrase, chasing shadows. He's fiercely intelligent, he's enormously successful, but when one of his children asks him a question about God, he says, "I'm completely flawed." But we don't need to grope around in the dark in that way. You know, in the whole of human history, there have only been two people who have been so great that the people around them didn't just say, "Who is this man?" but "What is this man?" Because he seemed to be more than human. They did it with Buddha and they did it with Jesus. But the interesting thing is that the reaction of those two men was entirely different. Buddha is said to have responded very emphatically, "No, don't look at me. It's not about me. I'm not God. Look at my Dharma, look at my teachings." But if you were to read on in John, you would see that when some people start to treat Jesus as God and worship him, he doesn't brush them off or tell them that they've misunderstood everything, that they're overreacting. Actually, he receives their worship gladly. Well, I wonder what part Jesus plays in your life at the moment. C.S. Lewis once said, "Christianity is a statement which, if false, is of no importance. And if true, is of infinite importance. The one thing it cannot be is moderately important." So perhaps I could put it like this. If at the moment my reaction to Jesus is not extreme, if I'm a little bit take it or leave it when it comes to Jesus, it can only mean that I haven't yet even begun to engage with the scale of his claims. We might dismiss this God claimer as something of a madman. Or we might get down on our knees and worship him. But the one thing he cannot be is moderately important. Jesus enables us to know God. Let me move on more briefly to our second key lesson for this morning. Jesus doesn't just enable us to know facts about God, but to know God personally as a father. Jesus enables us to know God as our father. When you think about our title today, Why Doesn't God Make Himself Clearer? The clear implication behind it is that the fault is on God's side. That if only he provided adequate evidence, we would all gladly believe. But the funny thing is, when you read the Gospels, that's not how it worked. The people of Jesus' day had all the evidence they could ever have asked for. They saw countless miracles. They saw him give sight to a man that had been born blind. They looked on as he raised a man back to life. They saw him feed thousands with just a few slices of bread and pieces of fish. Interestingly, the enemies of Jesus didn't dispute those miracles. They couldn't deny that they'd happened because the evidence surrounded them on every side. Think about it. In village life, everybody knows everybody else's business. So if little Johnny is born blind, everybody knows. And they know that Mrs. Thompson hasn't walked for years and years and years. And everybody hears as soon as Mr. Garrett dies. Everybody knows. But then in first century Palestine, all of a sudden, their equivalent of little Johnny, born blind, could see again. And Mrs. Thompson could not only walk, she'd enrolled for salsa classes. And a few days after his funeral, Mr. Garrett was alive again. You can't falsify that sort of evidence. And you can't deny it. But the interesting thing is that even in the face of all of that evidence, still some people chose not to believe. And as you read through John, the persistent and determined unbelief of some begs this crucial question of the reader. How will we respond to the evidence being set before us in this gospel? Verse 11 of our chapter highlights two possibilities. Just glance down to it with me. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. So here was Jesus, undeniably God on earth in history. And only some people chose to receive him, while others made the conscious decision not to do so. I love the way the truth is illustrated in Oscar Wilde's book, The Picture of Dorian Gray. Dorian Gray is an incredibly attractive young man whose portrait is painted so beautifully that when Dorian sees it, he pretty much falls in love with himself. And he makes a Faustian pact of sorts. His dream is that as he gets older in life, his own physical face will retain all of its youth and beauty, while all of the scars of age and careless living will be reflected on the portrait instead of on him. Dorian gets his wish. And he proceeds to commit himself to a lifetime of indulgence and sensuality and evil and even murder. And all the while, his own face remains pure. But the portrait becomes more and more haggard. One day, Dorian uncovers the portrait of his youth. I don't know what you do in those moments when you get a glimpse of what you are like on really like on the inside. You've done something, you've said something, and you have one of those, I simply cannot believe I did that moments. And as you look back on it, you almost think, well, maybe it didn't happen. I couldn't have done that. Initially, Dorian is terrified by what he's sickened by what he sees in front of him. But he's so fearful that he might be exposed in public that rather than facing up to that reality square on, he chooses instead to bury the portrait in the attic. The climax comes when the artist himself discovers the portrait. He confronts Dorian and implores him to turn his life around because he can see what happened. Incredibly, Oscar Wilde then has the artist quoting the Bible. He says, "Does God not say somewhere in the Bible, 'Come now, let us reason together, and though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as white as wool.'" And he pleads with Dorian to seek God's forgiveness. It's another opportunity for Dorian to face up to reality, to change. But he's so determined to silence this accusing voice, he chooses instead to reach for a knife and stab his friend to death. Well, when Jesus came into the world, his own did not receive him. They didn't lack evidence. They just didn't want to listen to him. When he told them of their sin, they hated him. In fact, so determined were they to silence his accusing voice that they strung him up on a cross and crucified him. Not many of us reject Jesus quite so graphically today. Most prefer just to ignore him, but the crime is the same. He came to his own, us, those he'd made, and we did not receive him. If anyone here were to continue down that road, it is a mistake that would haunt them for all eternity. But then here is this great promise of the Christian faith in verse 12. "But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God." To receive Jesus is just to accept him on his terms. And to everyone who received Jesus as their Lord and God, God personally gave the right to become one of his children. I don't know if you've come across Long Lost Families on ITV in the last few weeks. It's presented by Nikki Campbell and Davina McCall, and it's one of those slightly voyeuristic, sadly, documentary series that brings together individuals or families who have been separated for many, many years for one reason or another. A lady, I think in her 50s, reunited with a twin sister that she never knew that she had. A man in his 40s reunited with a child that he's not seen since his birth. As you can imagine, when the reunion comes, it's an incredible blend of questions and tears and hugs and hope. But as you watch, you find yourself longing for these strangers to be reconciled. Because it seems wrong that they should live apart any longer. Ladies and gentlemen, we were designed to know God as our Father. When we made the mistake of turning our back on him, we became estranged from him. Some will stay like that eternally. But it's not right that we should want to live in that way. And to any and to all who would come back to him, who would receive Jesus, God gives the right to become one of his children. Verse 12 is one of those verses into which you can insert your own name to help you feel the force of what John is saying. Not just to all who received him out there, kind of an abstract group, but to me, to Paul Clark, who did receive him, to you, whatever your name is, if you were to receive him, at that very moment, he would give you the right to become a child of God. And an heir, therefore, to the richest estate in the universe, heaven itself. Jesus enables us to know God as our Father. Our question asks God to make himself clearer. And when I'm asked that question, I'd like to turn it around and reply rather cheekily with another question. Well, how much clearer exactly would you like God to make himself? What would it take to convince you of God's existence? How much evidence would you need before you believed? I asked a friend that once, and he said, I want an email from God. If God sends me an email, then I will believe in him. To which I replied, well, are you sure? Would you really believe, or would you just think that it was spam and delete it? When you're offered millions of pounds by some Nigerian prince or whatever it happens to be, those spam things that come through, you delete that. Why would you believe that this was, he said, fair enough, I wouldn't believe it. Then what I'm going to need is I'm going to need God somehow to come to earth and make himself known to me in a form that I can understand and to prove to me beyond all doubt that he's God. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. He couldn't quite realize what he was saying. So I said, well, what kind of proof would you want? Would a series of apparently nature-defying feats of great power convince you that he was God? And he said, yeah, that would do it. I thought I pushed my luck. What would happen if he got killed? Then what? Without even a hint of irony, he said, then somehow he would have to defeat death, wouldn't he? And still the lights didn't go on. If I can put it like this, the fault for our unbelief does not lie with God. In the person of Jesus, he has made himself abundantly clear. If we choose to sit like children in the playground with our fingers in our ears, refusing to listen, we only have ourselves to blame. But here's the incredible thing. To those who do listen, to those who do receive him, he gives the right to become children of God. In his family now in this life, walking through the ups and downs, the trials and tribulations of life with God in me, with me, helping me and strengthening me. And beyond the grave, with him forever in a perfect new world, forevermore. That's why C.S. Lewis's line was right. Christianity is a statement which, if false, is of no importance. And if true, is of infinite importance. The one thing it cannot be is moderately important. I hope that's said enough to tee up some of the questions that you'll be asking in just a few moments' time. Back over to Jamie.
To work through the pile, so I'm going to be sifting through the questions as we go. Know this, I'm not going to be rooting out the difficult ones. I'm looking forward as much as you are to throwing the curveballs. At Clarkey. So if there's a difficult one in there, don't worry, we won't be dodging it, but we're a bit short of time. So Clarkey, let me start with this one. What is the evidence for Jesus other than the Bible?
Thank you. It's a great question. The answer is that I'll answer it and then I'll come back and deny the question, if I may. There is a whole load of evidence in a series of both Jewish and Roman historical texts, Josephus, Pliny, Tacitus, and a number of others. I could give you the list afterwards of the things that we would know about Jesus, even if we never had a Bible open in front, the Bible had never been preserved. We would know that he was said to be a doer of wonderful deeds. We'd know that he had the name Christ. We'd know that people claimed to see where he was born, his name, that he was killed under Pontius Pilate, that people claimed to see him alive after he was dead, and that they worshipped him as God. So a whole string of things that we would know from extra-biblical sources, even if we never had a Bible. The reason I dispute the question slightly is that I want to know why we need to set the Bible to one side in the first place. Actually, the Bible is the best evidence. It's slightly like asking the question, if you were trying to you wanted to get to the bottom of the state of the HIV virus in Africa, but you were going to deny all evidence from the medical community and all NGO organizations. You think, well, why would you do that? Actually, sure, they've got a vested interest in recording that evidence, but they want it to be accurate. It's the best evidence that there is going out there. So why set it to one side even before we start? You may want to ask the question, is the Bible accurate? And that's a terrific question to ask. And the talk that Charlie's going to be giving on Thursday night will address that head on. But although there is loads of stuff outside of the Bible, actually this is still the best place to go for accurate historical information about him.
Thank you. And thank you for reminding us of that talk on Thursday. Someone has asked that question. How can I trust what the Bible says about Jesus and what he says is true? Can you give us 30 seconds on that just to get us started?
Sure. You would need to be sure that the gospel writers were trying to write down accurate history, that they managed to write down accurate history, and that their texts were accurately preserved. Were they trying to? Did they? And have we still got them? Those would be your three questions. And I guess those are the things that Charlie's going to be talking about. Let me just answer the first of those. Were they trying to write down accurate history? The answer is yes, they were. There's a verse in at the start of one of the letters, also written by the Apostle John, that we read from today. This is what he says. That which we have seen and heard. No, let me start before then. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and have touched with our hands concerning the word of life, that which we have seen and heard, we proclaim also to you. He's saying that everything that we are saying is that with which we had a first-hand encounter. We saw it with our eyes. We heard it with our ears. We touched him with our hands, risen from the dead. And that is the content of our message. Everything about Christianity falls apart if the historicity of Christianity can be disproved. There is no Christianity left if these things are not historically accurate. And that's why they were so determined to write them down accurately, and why, Charlie will argue, they were in fact able to do so, and there's been no Chinese whispers ever since. I'm sorry if that's stolen the talk. He'll say it much better on Thursday night. Do go along there.
Great. I think following on from that then, two questions along the same line. Saying God made himself clear to people 2,000 years ago isn't the same as us being given miraculous proof now. Why doesn't God still do miraculous signs for each generation? What harm could it do to be super clear? And I think similar, why, if God makes himself known through Jesus, did he do so only until 2,000 years ago? Why do we not have Jesus with us now?
Sure, thank you. Again, brilliant questions. Historical events are by definition unique. I've used the illustration before. It's rather crude. I apologize for that. That if I'd missed the birth of one of my children, because that is a unique historical event, if I'm not there, I've missed it. It wouldn't be terribly good kind of wandering into the labour ward and saying to Emily, oh, would you mind if we just kind of shoved it all back in so that I could see it? Could you do it again? Of course, that's not going to happen. For reasons I won't explain to you in detail now, I probably wouldn't be here if I tried to say that, I think would be the case. But it is by definition a unique and unrepeatable historical event. And the coming of God into the world in God's understanding of the universe at the very best time and in the very best place in history, it was also a unique event that cannot be repeated. But what I want to say is that though there is 2,000 years of distance that separates us from that event, it doesn't mean that we don't have access to it. Because we have exactly that in the eyewitness historical accounts before you in the Bible. Now, I don't know what you're like when big things are happening. The royal wedding, take as an example. I wasn't there. If I'd gone and tried to kind of be in the crowds, I don't know if you did, you might have caught a kind of a sneaking glimpse for a few seconds of someone driving past in an open-top car or something. But that would have been the extent of your interaction with it. But so you wouldn't have been able to have an exact feel for everything that happened on the day. Were there not other eyewitnesses who were telling and recording all of the details for you so that you could come back and have access to them later? Now, if I'd been around when Jesus was alive, I'm absolutely convinced that the day he came to town, I'd have had a doctor's appointment or something, and I would have missed all of the kind of healing miracle things, or I'd have been stuck at the back of the crowd, I'd have overslept, there'd be too much background noise, I'd have been saying, well, what did he say? And you're free from any of that. In fact, we're in a more privileged position 2,000 years later because we have everything recorded for us here. So it's not kind of half catching a glimpse of something and half hearing something that you need to base your eternal destiny on. It's accurate historical information reliably preserved.
Thank you very much. Let's keep moving. A question that the text throws up, I think, is a good question. To what extent does Jesus reveal God, and to what extent is Jesus God?
Thank you. That's a brilliant question. He reveals God because he is God. I think that's the point. The doctrine of the Trinity will take us past a quarter to 12 or 10 to 12 or whatever time that we were going to say. In essence, the way that the Bible speaks of it is that there's one God, but that he exists in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so when we speak of God, often we're speaking of God the Father, God the Father who remained in heaven when Jesus came to earth. God the Son came to earth. Now, God the Father and God the Son are identical in every way. They're made of the same stuff, if you like, except that one is Father and one is Son. So it's not that the Son, Jesus, is less God than God the Father. It's not that the Father is more God than God the Son. They're both God, identical in every way, except in their relationship, that one is Father and one is Son. And so you can say of Jesus both that as the Son, he is revealing the Father to us, and that in his essence, he is God himself. Both of those things are true for reasons that it would take me too long to explain now. But please do talk to your friend about that if that was your question. The person who brought you this morning, they would love to talk about it some more. Or come on Christianity Explored, the course that Jamie mentioned. Read through John's Gospel. One of the things that John's doing is teasing out that relationship for us. Come chat to me afterwards if you want to.
I mean, here's a follow-up that might make it more concrete. What can you say to someone who says they believe in God but do not believe in Jesus as his son?
That's a cracking question. In John chapter 5, there is exactly this point that is made. Would you just turn there with me on page 1073? Teasing out the relationship between the Father and the Son, God the Father, God the Son. And on page 1073, John chapter 5, verse 22. Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son. Here's the reason. That all may honour the Son just as they honour the Father. Whoever does not honour the Son does not honour the Father who sent him. Okay, there's the answer to your question. What if I'm a God person, but I'm not a big fan of Jesus? Answer, you can't be. If you don't deal with God's son, Jesus, you are being as offensive to God, the Father, as you possibly could be. It's simply not possible to put a wedge of separation between them. If you want the Father, you have to go through the Son. Jesus said, no one comes to the Father except through me. If you want the Father, you have to go through the Son. You can't have the Son without the Father.
And again, I think this follows on. Just a minute or so on this. I'm happy living as I am. I don't think I need God. What happens if we don't receive Jesus?
Thanks. Back a page in the Gospel. I just want you to see that I'm getting these things from the lips of Jesus himself rather than just making them up. If you're on page 1071... Page 1071, and the last verse, just on the right-hand column there, of verse 36, the last verse of chapter 3. Here's the summary. Lots more could be said from John. Whoever believes in the Son has eternal life. Whoever does not obey the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God remains on him. It's reminding us of the thing that we saw today. There are two groups of people and only two. There's those who receive Jesus as their Lord and God, and those who don't. Here there are those who believe in Jesus and those who do not obey him. There's no middle ground, there's no fence. And though we may be able to go through this life for 20, 30, 50, 70, 100 years, however long we have, making a relatively good fist of life and being relatively happy in the group of people that is ignoring Jesus or not believing in him or not accepting him, not receiving him, the day you die will change that forever. You will die and you will face Jesus as your judge. And on that day, this verse says, the wrath of God shall remain upon you forevermore. That is not something to take lightly. We could talk about it in greater length and detail, but ignoring Jesus may work for the relatively short period of time that you're alive on this earth, but for the hundreds of millions of years of your conscious existence on the other side of the grave, it would be a terrible mistake. Please don't do that.
Paul, thank you very much. I've got more questions that I'd love to ask. I'd love to just keep talking about these things. It's 2:15. I want to be good to my
work. Can I say something positive to end on? It just feels as though that's rather sad, doesn't it? I mean, that's the bad news. The great news is that it doesn't have to be that way. To all who received him, who received Jesus as Lord, who believed in his name, he gave the right to be called children of God. That's the great offer at the heart of Christianity. Restored to the relationship with God for which we were designed and made. That's the way that you'll explore your potential as a human being on this earth. That's the way that you'll know the joy and the fulfillment that comes of walking through life with God. That's the way you get given a place in his new creation, which lasts forevermore. That's the offer that we ought to take seriously and investigate thoroughly. Thank you very much for listening.